good deal. Chuck Swindoll tells a story of about a conversation with a Christian leader at one time. The man said that after a lot of discussion and prayer, he and his wife felt called to Uganda to minister. And so they picked up their family from the United States, moved to and went to Africa. They flew to Kenya first, and he put up his wife and kids in a hotel in Kenya, then rented a car and went across the border into Uganda. And this is what he says. One of the first things that caught my eye when I came into the village where I was going to spend my first night were that several young kids with automatic weapons shooting them off into the sky. As I drove by, they stared at me and pointed their guns. So naturally, I started to wonder if God was really in this decision. So after a long day of exploring Uganda, I pulled up to a dingy, dimly lit hotel, went inside and went up to the registration counter. The clerk only spoke just a very little English. He said there was only one bed available. So I said, well, I'll take it. I walked up the two flights of stairs, opened the door, turned on the light, which was a naked bulb hanging from a cord over the table. And I saw in the room there were two beds, one unmade and one made. And I realized, oh no, I am sharing this room with another person. He said, I dropped to my knees and said, Lord, I'm afraid. I'm in a country I don't know, a culture I'm totally unfamiliar with. I have no idea who's sleeping in that bed. Please show me you're involved in this move. He said, just as I finished my prayer, the door flung open and there stood a 6-foot-5-inch African frowning at me, saying in beautiful British English, what are you doing in my room? I muttered, well, they gave me this bed. I'll only be here for one night. And he said, what are you doing in my country? Well, I'm with a Christian organization. It's called the Navigators. Ah, the Navigators. Suddenly, the tall African broke into an enormous grin, threw his arms around his new roommate, laughed out loud, and lifted him off the floor and danced around the room with him. praise God, said the African. For 2 years, I've prayed that God would send someone from that organization. Pulled out a little scripture memory pack, pointed at the bottom, the verse where it says, Navigators, Colorado Springs, Colorado. He said, are you from Colorado Springs? He said, well, I was, but we're moving to Uganda to work for the Navigators in the country. That man, that 6-foot-5 African, became a board member for the new Ministry of Navigators in Uganda. He helped that American find a place to live, helped him with the language, and became his new best friend in that place. That is the providence of God. The providence of God. And we see that in the passage we're in for today. We're still in the series in Genesis, and we're going to look at that. You can turn to Genesis. We're going to start in chapter 43. And we're covering actually 3 chapters for today. Don't be afraid. I'm not going to read the whole thing. We all want to get to lunch at some point, right? So I'm going to kind of talk through some of these things. This is the ongoing saga of Joseph. And, he went from the prison to the palace. He went from being a slave to the ruler. He's overseeing the storage of grain in the good years for 7 years. Now he's distributing grain. He's in year 2 of the 7 years of distributing grain to people during this famine. And last week we talked about his brothers coming down from Canaan to get grain and all those things that happened there. And he remembers his dreams. He recognizes them. He gives them a hard time. So he's trying to figure out what he's going to do, how he's going to handle this. This is just out of the blue for him. And then he gives them grain and tells them, okay, you want to come back? You got to bring your younger brother. And they were confused. Why in the world is that important? So let me talk through chapters 43 and 44 if you've got your Bibles. You can kind of follow along or just listen. And then I'm going to read a bit of 45 and we'll make some applications. So that's kind of where we're headed today. All right, chapter 43, when it starts out, Jacob's family runs out of the grain they purchased. They went down there, bought that, they run out of the grain, and the boys want to go down and get more. Dad says, no way, you've got to have to bring Benjamin. I'm not going to let him go. And they twist his arm. And I talked to him, look, you want to starve? You want your families to starve, or are we going to go down there? The only way we can do this is to get Benjamin down there. Finally, he talks him into it, and they go. Benjamin apparently has become Jacob's favorite in absence of Rachel, his wife who died, his favorite wife, and Joseph, who he thinks is dead. So the brothers say, can't starve, so we got to go, and they end up going down there. And once they get there, Joseph surprises them with a meal. I mean, it's very interesting that all kinds of people are coming down to get grain from Egypt. They've got that. And he says, come to my house for a meal. Nobody else is going to his house for a meal. And they wonder what's going on, what's up with that. They're a little suspicious. But they get some good food. They notice that they notice that the brothers are seated in birth order, oldest to youngest, and Benjamin's the youngest. And then they notice this, that Benjamin has five times as much food as everybody else does. And I think Joseph probably did this to gauge whether or not they would get jealous of Benjamin, like they got jealous of him earlier. And so, where was I here? Sorry. But they don't treat Benjamin poorly, and they get their grain, they get the meal, and they start to go home. But we see in chapter 44 that Joseph has had his silver cup placed surreptitiously in Benjamin's saddlebags. They don't know about this, and they start to leave town. Then the steward comes after them and says, you've stolen the master's silver cup. Why would we do that? We brought double the silver. You know why? You're crazy. We didn't do that. I'm going to have to check. You got to go right ahead and check. There's no problem. And they go through all the saddlebags, and they find out there the silver cup is discovered in Benjamin's saddlebags. Oh, their shoulders slump, and they go, oh, no, here we go again. And they all troop back to Joseph's place. And they think, now we're in trouble. Now we're all going to have to stay here. Now we're going to be slaves. What are we going to tell our dad? This is terrible. Joseph did this, we think, to see, to gauge their reaction to, would they sell Benjamin out like they did him? They sold Joseph out, right? We don't like you. We're jealous. Here you go. Sold to slave traders. Are they going to similarly sell Benjamin out? And he's pleased to find out that they don't sell their brother out. In fact, they defend him. And then Judah steps up. And Judah is the guy who went off from the family on his own. Judah is the guy who at one time went to a prostitute. And now, but Judah is the one who steps up to Joseph when Joseph says, you guys can all go, but I'm going to have to keep Benjamin here. He stole the silver cup. And Judah is the one that says, you can't do that. You can't do that. You don't know what that youngest son means to our father. In fact, this is going to kill him. Our father's going to die if he finds out. Let me stay in his place. And that show of emotion, that show of sacrifice to brothers who were not given to sacrifice was so overwhelming to Joseph, he cannot contain himself anymore. And so we're going to pick it up in chapter 45, verse 1. If you got your Bibles, you can read, or it's on the screen as well. Then Joseph could control himself no longer before all his attendants, and he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. And so there was no one but Joseph with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were unable to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Now, I'm sure, let me pause there, excuse me. I'm sure they were terrified. It's just this didn't compute at all. Makes no sense what's going on here. This is a powerful guy who is in charge of everything, and he sold us grain. He's the powerful guy who put us in jail for 3 days. He's the guy who says, I do this, and everybody does it. And now he's sobbing loudly, and then he tells everybody to leave. What's he going to do to us? Is he going to kill us? Is he going to torture us? I have no idea what he's doing. And this guy who previously claimed that we were spies and previously said we were thieves and we weren't, now he's claiming that he's Joseph. Just doesn't make any sense. No wonder they were terrified. What kind of trick is he going to pull now? Verse 4. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed, do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing or reaping. God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now, hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me ruler of all Egypt. Come down. Don't delay.'" Now, it's possibly starting to make sense to the brothers. This powerful leader knows about that Joseph was sold. He didn't tell them that. How did they know that? And they might begin to recall the dreams he told them about years earlier. Then they think, wait a minute, he sat us in birth order from the very beginning. How did he know our birth order? And then he begins to speak to them in Hebrew. Previously he had used an interpreter. Now, you can look at that, chapter 45, verse 12, indicates that he may have been speaking in their own language. They go, "Oh my goodness, this is Joseph, our brother. He's the ruler." So they're getting it now. And I'm sure one of their first thoughts would be, is he going to retaliate? I mean, we treated him horribly. Is he going to retaliate for what we've done? He's got the power. My goodness, the power sure has shifted from when he was 17 and his brother sold him out. Now he's holding all the cards. What's he going to do? But he doesn't look vengeful. In fact, he looks downright conciliatory. And I think that's an indication. The indication of that is because three times he repeats, you know, "It wasn't you, it was God who sent me. God sent me here. He was the one who did this. This is for the saving of lives." And then he says even more clearly, at the last time he says it, "So then it was not you who sent me here. It was God who sent me here." It was his idea. And the brothers are starting to get it. They're starting to understand. They weep together. They gather around their long-lost brother. They hug together. And they talk about it for quite some time. And you can imagine all that they've got to catch up on, that they've been separated all this time. And that's our story for today. That's where we're headed. That's it for Genesis anyway. And that's a very emotional story. And there's more emotion to come as well when Dad comes down. Here's my big idea for today. Big idea. Trust in God's providence. Trust in God's providence. You know, there's a commentary in the Psalms on this thing that we just read about the story of Joseph. It's in Psalm 105. And here's what it says. "He," that is God, "called down famine on the land and destroyed all their supplies of food, and he sent a man before them, Joseph, sold as a slave. They bruised his feet with shackles, his neck was put in irons, till what he foretold came to pass, till the word of the Lord proved him true." That's the providence of God. It wasn't the brothers who did this. It was ultimately God who sent him down there. And here's a definition you can see on the screens of the providence of God. God directs the affairs of his people to fulfill his purposes. God directs the affairs of his people to fulfill his purposes. God directs your affairs. Your affairs. The things in your life that's going on, he directs those things to fulfill his purposes. And he knows that. He is God. One commentator said this: in a mysterious way, God made use of the ill will of his brothers to achieve their rescue in famine. My goodness, how in the world does that work? God used the sinful behavior of the brothers to accomplish what he wanted. Is that not crazy? But God can do that. Absolutely, he can do that. He can do everything. Look at Ephesians chapter 1 here. "In him we were chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will." God uses everything. So we're personally chosen by God. We're personally predestined by him. Our church is as well. But that same God that works in our church and in us to predestine us and send us in his direction also does that to the nations. Look what it says in Psalm 22. Dominion belongs to the Lord, and He rules over the nations. What He does for each of us, He also does for the nations. And we see that with the example of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar. And he was humbled by God after being warned and then humbled by God for a 7-year period of time. This is what he says after that period of time. It dawns on him who is really in charge. And this is what he says. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" So not one of us, in the words of Nebuchadnezzar, can say to God, "What have you done?" He's in charge. Providence of God. Even in our bumbling, even in our sin, even in our mismanagement, God uses that for his good. He accomplishes his will even through our negative things. Are you glad for that? I'm glad we have a providential God who uses those things. So what does the providence of God mean for Joseph and his brothers? I've got 5 things that I think it means that I think we can glean from the text today that also would apply to us. We'll talk about that in a while. First thing the providence of God means, understanding. Understanding. All of a sudden, these brothers were enlightened. You can almost see the light come to their eyes as they began sifting through the last several years that were so confusing. Let's think about what the brothers went through. I want you to put yourself in the sandals of Joseph's brothers. So there's a famine in the land, and the famine's striking everyone, and they want to take care of their families. And so Dad says, going on to Egypt, they're selling grain down there. And they think it's a relatively simple idea. We're going to bring some money. We're going to travel down there, buy grain, and go back. But it doesn't turn out that way. While they're down there, this main ruler, man, he starts questioning us. And then he says we're spies. And then he puts us in jail for 3 days. And then he says, you know, you can have the grain, but you've got to bring your younger brother. If you want more grain, you've got to bring your younger brother back. And they were forced to leave brother Simeon there. And that's not what they expected to happen at all. I mean, Benjamin is dad's favorite. You know, they know that's not going to go over well with him. And it didn't. And Jacob didn't want him to go back. And the brothers said, we're going to starve. And so he says, all right, but. And he begrudgingly sends Benjamin down. And then they get treated to a lunch at this ruler's house. It doesn't make any sense at all. Why do we get a lunch like this? And why does Benjamin get so much? All right, we got what we need. Thank you very much. Good lunch. Great grain. We'll see you next time. And they pack things up and they start to head out of town when the steward of the main ruler catches up with them and says, why are you thieves? We treated you so well. You're thieves. No, we're not thieves. Why would we steal anything like silver? We brought you double the silver because we wanted to make sure we had everything covered. I mean, we guarantee. Yeah, no, there's nobody stealed. Nobody stole. Don't worry about it. Well, they've searched through and so there's the silver cup of Benjamin was discovered they wonder, now what's going on? What's God doing to us now? And they slink back into Joseph's place. And Joseph said to them, all right, look, I'm not going to keep all of you, but just Benjamin. He stole the silver. We're just going to keep him here. And then Judah steps up, like we mentioned, and sacrificially volunteers to stay in his place. Then that ruler, all of a sudden, and we don't understand why in the world this happened, then that ruler tells everybody, screams, everybody out of here, except these guys. And then they're starting to freak out a little bit. And then he starts sobbing out loud, and they're going, what in the world is going on? Why is this all happening? Then this ruler cries out, I am Joseph, I'm your brother. They go, that just doesn't fit together at all. But then this ruler starts to speak to them in their native language and they can understand him. And then he knows the birth order of these guys and he takes off his Egyptian headgear, wipes some of the Egyptian eyeliner out of his eyes and says, come close to me. I'm Joseph. And he knew that they had sold him into Egypt. He knows too much. And light starts to dawn on these guys. Understanding starts to come to them that God has been in back of this all the time. Absolutely amazing. all the strange stuff that they had occurred to them over the last couple of years, it just didn't make sense, now begins to make sense. And that's what happened when we can look at and trust in the providence of God. That God is in back of stuff that happens to us. Not, he might not cause it, but he can use it. And God is over these things. And that's a comfort. Now that all makes sense. And the providence of God helps us to see things in that light. This makes sense because of who God is. He's over that all. He oversees the whole thing. And at some point when you and I mean, you may be going through something now, but at some point we are going to see the providence of God, the hand of God involved in our lives, and we're going to go, oh, okay. Now I see what's going on. So what can come within the providence of God is understanding or light that God's got this. Here's the second thing I think that we're brought to, at least to Joseph anyway, a lack of bitterness. A lack of bitterness. And let me begin with this. Mike Love, anybody Beach Boys fans here? I am a Beach Boys fan. Mike Love, he's now 83 years old, if you can believe that. He was one of the original members of the Beach Boys. He contributed to hits like California Girls and Help Me Rhonda and I Get Around and others like that. Here's a picture of Mike Love then and now. I mean, he's even older than the one on the right there. He did an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, and in the interview, they said, what important thing do we need to know about Mike Love? He says, I meditate twice a day, every day, twice a day. Helps me deal with whatever I happen to be dealing with. It helps me to cope. I do this to cope with things. Well, Mike Love has had a lot to cope with because his first wife had an affair with Dennis Wilson, who was also in the Beach Boys. Mike Love wrote a bunch of the songs that they sang, but never got credit for it, for publishing them, so he didn't get the royalties that were due him, and he ended up suing the other guys, especially Brian Wilson, who was the kind of the genius behind the Beach Boys. And so so the divided relationships, the financial stuff, all of a strain. And so Rolling Stone magazine said, well, has daily meditation, twice daily meditation helped you? And he said, well, I think it is. And they asked him this, if Brian Wilson were to stand right here before you, what would you say to him? And he said, well, I'd probably say, I love you, and moisture gathering in the corners of his eyes, and I'd say, I love what we did together. Let's do it again. But then Mike Love gave his head a shake. The moisture leaves his eyes. He frowns, and he gives voice to the thing that no meditation can cover over. He says, but I have been ostracized. I have been vilified. And he begins to recount those things that happened to him again. And the meditation can't really cover those things up. The bitterness is still there. Now you would think Joseph would have a reason to have bitterness. His own brothers sold him out. His own brothers wanted to kill him. His old brothers got money from him becoming a slave, and then he was a slave, and then he was in prison. And then he had to wait for years for an answer. He's all this stuff that he happened, and yet there's an alarming lack of bitterness in Joseph's response to his brothers. Where does that come from? Well, Joseph knew God, and he was close to God. But he is trusting in the providence of God, because this all begins to make sense to him as he recognizes that, hey, this wasn't my brother's. This was God's plan. And he's doing this to save lives. And so he's able to jettison his bitterness because he sees God's hand involved in that. And that's something I think you and I can do as well. When we are bitter with someone that's done something to us, we can say, wait a minute, God has been involved in this. He saw God's hand. And how can Joseph be bitter when he sees that God has really orchestrated this whole thing to save lives? So God's providence, properly seen, can help us to drop bitterness in our lives over things that have happened. It also brings number three, reconciliation. reconciliation. I mean, gone is Joseph's bitterness. We know that. Gone, hopefully, is the brother's guilt. We're going to see that, and it's going to go in phases away from them. Hope is back. This all begins to make sense. Now they can hug one another and start to talk and catch up on things. I mean, the elephant in the room of Jacob's family was what the brothers did to their own brother and how they lied to their father to cover it up. You don't think that would have an impact on a family? When one part of the family does this, or a significant part of the family does something that lies and covers it up, that's just the elephant in the room. And that hasn't been processed. That hasn't been talked about. That hasn't been confronted. And yet with this idea of the providence of God dawning on them, they can now do that and go, oh, God's been involved in this all along. Seeing God's hand in what's happening to us can do that. A.W. Tozer once said this, "Has it ever occurred to you that 100 pianos all tuned to the same fork," that's a tuning fork in the picture there, "are automatically tuned to one another?" The brothers and Joseph are now tuned to one another. And it was God's tuning fork, bing, and they were on the same wavelength, singing the same note. Because of that, they can reconcile with one another. And they can trust God because they can become reconciled. They begin to talk about these things because they saw the hand of God, the providence of God. Providence also brings provision, number four on that. God was working to save lives, and this food, that means food to eat and sustenance and being taken care of. And that's what God does. This is something that God does. We see that in Psalm 104. We see that in many places. Here's an example. He makes grass grow for the cattle, plants for people to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens human hearts, oil to make their faces shine, and bread that sustains their hearts. Let me ask if anybody has, anybody started those little starter plants in your windowsill yet? Anybody? And that's a little early. I see that hand. Yeah, very good. That's a little early to do that, be coming up, but it's getting close, isn't it? You know, and it's so fun to watch those little things, the seeds that you grow, poke up those little green shoots and start to unfurl. I mean, it's just amazing. How can that happen? That's just, to me, it's almost a miracle every time I see that. That's the design of God. God designed that. This is His world He created. And He made that world for us so that things grow. And we can depend on that seed, and we can depend on that soil and moisture and sunlight. That's His plan. God did that for us. He makes it happen. He sustains us. And He does this for everyone. We see this in Nehemiah. "You alone are Lord. You made the heavens, even the highest heavens, and all their starry hosts, the earth and all that is in it, the seas and all that's in them. You give life to everything, and the multitudes of heaven worship you." Isn't that good? God gives us life, and we see this in the ability to work and provide, and we see this in things grown and animals grown, and God takes care of us. So what God did for Joseph and his clan, and Jacob and his clan, for Israel and the whole, all the group of guys, He does that for us. He takes care of us. Makes sure we have what we need. God had intended to bless the entire world through this clan of Jacob. And how did He do that? By bringing the Messiah. He brought the Messiah through Israel to bless us, you and me, and the entire world. They were about 70 people at this time. That's as big as the nation of Israel was. And I think, this is conjecture on my part, I think that had they stayed in Canaan at this crucial time, and there would have been really easy to assimilate to the values of other people around him, to begin to intermarry and do that to the people around him. But taken down to Egypt, they became, of necessity, a peculiar people. I mean, they were given their own little plot of land. The Egyptians didn't like shepherds. They didn't trust foreigners. And so, of necessity, they had to isolate. And in the isolation, they grew strong and they grew in their faith, and they stayed together in that way. And God let them grow. He provided for them all that time so they would grow large, and they grew to at least 1 million people, I think, by some estimates. And then God let them become slaves. to upend their comfort. They were so comfortable where they were at, unless they really didn't like where they were at, they probably weren't going to move. God upended them so that they would want to leave, so he could take them and put them in the promised land. God has long-range provision plans for you and for me, thankfully. Finally, providence should bring, number five, trust. Trust. See, once you understand that God holds it all together and that the world operates on his economy and that he's taking care of us, you should be able to say, Lord, I trust you. No, not sure what's going on, but I trust you. And one of the ways we see this is in Psalm 139. And this is the psalmist saying, you hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too lofty for me to attain. Do you get the picture that the psalmist is saying here? As you go through life, God is here and God is here. And he puts his hand upon us. There's nowhere we go outside of the presence of God. There's nowhere we go without him being with us. You can flee anywhere, you know, up to the hills and the darkness and light, doesn't matter. God is there with us. And if you understand that God's got you and that he's with you, you can trust him. You can rest. You can relax. You can let your shoulders slump and go, God's got this. Regardless of what you happen to see around you. Let's say you're on a basketball team and the coach is doing something. He calls for a timeout. And you're wondering, why a timeout? I think we were scoring, you know. Why do you have a timeout? It could be a number of things. The coach could see that there's something troubling about their defense and wants to correct it. Maybe an opposing player's got a hot hand and they want to kind of slow him down and stop him from his hot hand, and so you take a timeout. Maybe it's at a crucial part of the game, usually toward the end of the game, and it's a close game, and you call a timeout just before somebody shoots a free throw to make him think about it, like icing the kicker in the NFL. I mean, maybe there's a play, the coach sees a weakness in the defense, in the other team, and he wants to run a specific play to help your team win. And you're just a player on the court. You're just playing, trying your hard to guard your guy and make a basket. But the coach sees all of these things and more, all these things he's taking into consideration, and you don't know why he's called a timeout, but you trust that the timeout is what's needed at this point. Why would it be any different with God? I mean, as our heavenly coach, he sees way more than we see. He knows our future and our past. He knows how it all works together. He knows where we have to be tomorrow. He knows how our family is going to be put together next week and next month and next decade. Of necessity, we should trust our heavenly coach. He's got what we need, and he'll take care of it. Can anybody here quote to me Proverbs 3, 5, and 6?
Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, and all your ways, and he will direct your
path. It's a good one, isn't it? A number of you knew that. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge him. He will direct your paths. That's what we're talking about. If you know the providence of God, you can say those words with confidence. Here's one of my favorites, Psalm 62. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your hearts to him, for God is our refuge. Trust in him at all times. Now, when you read on in Genesis, you read this whole story of Joseph and his brothers, you find out that when they go back to their dad, these brothers are actually excited about moving back down to Egypt. And they talk their dad into it. Look at all this stuff. Look at what God's taking care of. It's amazing. Now, a day or two before, they couldn't wait to get their grain and go back home. Now they're excited about staying in Egypt. How did that happen? Where did that come from? They see the hand of God involved in this. They see what he's done. They are trusting him. It's God's purposes. God used the sin of the brothers to save many lives. Put Joseph down there. They could make the totally unexpected move at this point that they wouldn't have considered a week earlier. Now they can make it in confidence and be excited about it because they see God's hand. They see the providence of God. Now, I don't know if they trusted God before that. I mean, sometimes it looks like they did, sometimes they didn't. But I think there's evidence in the text that Joseph trusted God even when he was taken as a slave, even when he was in prison, he continued to speak about God and trust God. So you don't need to understand how it's all going to work out now if you trust in God, if you trust who He is. You don't have to have the picture now, but you'll have it one day. I think God is pleased when we trust Him, even when we don't see how it's going to work out. Don't you think that? When Jesus was speaking to Thomas, the one who doubted, what did He say? You have seen and believed. Blessed are those who don't see and still believe. There's something about trust that pleases God. And what it is, I think, is that we understand His character. When you trust God, you understand how good He is and how caring He is and how He hems us in behind Him before and puts His hand upon us. And once you got that picture in your mind, you can throw your hands up and go, Lord, I trust You. I don't see how it's going to work out, but I trust You. Trust is important. I've shared this before. Kurt, do I have this on the screen for the Jaybird Crow Boat? Yeah, I've shared this before, but it's so good. This is from a novel called Jaybird Crow. It's by Wendell Berry. It's about 20 years old as a novel. But in it, the character in that novel says this: often I have not known where I was going until I was already there. I've had my share of desires and goals, but my life has come to me, or I've gone to it, mainly by way of mistakes and surprises. Can you say that? My life has been like that. Mainly by way of mistakes and surprises, I've bumbled along to where I am. Often, I have received better than I deserved. That's true, too. Often, my faintest hopes have rested on bad mistakes. I'm an ignorant pilgrim crossing a dark valley. And yet, for a long time, looking back, I've been unable to shake off the feeling that I have been led. Make of that what you will. And I'll bet that many of you here could say the same thing. Crossing a dark valley, you have mistakes and problems, you don't see how it's all going to work out, but as you look back in your life, you have been led. Can you say that? God has led you? Absolutely, He has. It's the providence of God. Now, the character in that says, as he looked back, he's seen the leading of God. And here's the interesting thing about providence. You normally only see it with hindsight. You normally only see it as you look back after everything else. Now, I know we have a mix of political opinions here, so please be patient with me. Bear with me and be patient with me and give me a little grace, and hopefully you'll see where I'm going with this. 4 years ago, many people were dismayed to have Joe Biden take office. I was one of them. A lot of people thought the election was rigged or stolen. I'm one of those. And at that time, 4 years ago, many prophetic types said confidently, Trump is going to have 2 terms. Trump's going to be in office. And then Joe Biden was in office, and those prophetic types had to kind of back off and apologize, and they must have gotten it wrong, and what in the world happened? But 4 years later, I can look back and go, you know, I think that makes sense. I think we needed those 4 years. There was a purpose to the Biden years, absolutely. I think it allowed Trump to be better prepared this time around. 4 years ago, my wife Deb, had a sense that God was telling her you could enjoy the ride because it's all going to work out. And for the most part, she did trust God. Other times she didn't, depending on the circumstances. She trusted in the providence of God, and I think we can as well. As we look back, and now what happened, you can say that, now that makes sense. Now, to those of you who think opposite than I do, we love you. Glad you're a part of things. Might those of you who don't want Trump in office, just hold on for 4 years, and you'll be able to look back and you go, you know, I think God was involved in that. And I think from the book of Daniel, chapter 4 especially, or chapters 2 and 4, the book of Daniel, you'll be able to say with confidence that God has puts the one in office whom He wants. So you have an opportunity to look back as well. Now, how might we apply the providence of God to this today? Let me ask you this. Can you look back in your life and say, you know what, I saw God involved in that? It didn't make sense at the time, but looking back, I can see that made sense. Can any of you say that? Yeah, absolutely. So we can apply that to the future and say, at some point, it's going to make sense. Hold on to that. Now, let me ask you this. Some of you I know are going through some hard times right now. What is it you're going through? What dark thing clouds your vision at this point? Maybe it's family. Maybe it's an occupation. Maybe it's an illness, some kind of physical thing. Whatever it is. How many of you have been asking God, why? Why is this going on in my life right now? That's a question we don't normally get an answer to, at least not immediately. Well, wait for the hindsight. If you know the God of providence and can trust Him, at some point you'll have understanding. At some point you'll be able to see how that all works together. In the fall of 1991, Jerry Sitzer was driving a minivan with his family and his mother in it. Jerry Sitzer is a professor at Whitworth. I think he's still a professor there. He has been. And a drunk driver crossed lanes, smashed head-on into that minivan, and Sitzer's wife, 4-year-old child, and mother died in that accident. Three of his kids survived. He and three kids survived. Sitzer wrote some books about that, and here's an excerpt from a book by Jerry Sitzer. My son David is and always has been quiet and reflective. After the accident, he was the least likely to talk about it, but when he chose to, he usually had something significant to say or to ask. Our best conversations happened in the car. One particular conversation has stayed fresh in my memory. David was about 8. At the time, we were driving to a soccer match some distance from our home. David was quiet. The car was full of silence, not a heavy silence, but a liquid silence, as if some question were brewing within him. David suddenly asked, "Do you think Mom sees us right now?" Jerry said, I paused to ponder, "I don't know, David. I think maybe she sees us. I don't know. Why do you ask?" He said, "I don't see how she could, Dad. I thought heaven was full of happiness. How could she bear to see us so sad?" Of course, going through Jerry Sitzer's mind, you know, could Linda witness our pain in heaven, and how's that possible? How could she bear that? He began to think about that. And then finally he said, I think she does see us. But she sees the whole story, including how it all turns out, which is beautiful to her. It's going to be a good story, David. It's going to be a good story. And that's the kind of faith that Jerry Sitzer had for his family when that was broken apart in that way. And I know some of you are going through the death of an individual or a sickness that you don't like or something that's happened, a loss of somebody, a rift in the family, and you don't like it. But can you say with Jerry Sitzer, it's going to be a good story? If you can, you're displaying faith. You're trusting in the God who has His hand involved in all of our lives and who is the providential God of all creation. Can you say with the psalmist, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Did God know about that illness? Did God know about that accident? Did God know about that loss? Yes, He did. Can you rest in the knowledge that Jesus knows everything about you and what you're going through, and He's got a hand involved in that? And Jesus says something to you, and I want you to take this personally, and I want you to think about this, the words of Jesus being spoken specifically to you, Matthew chapter 10. Are not 2 sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. And can you hang your hat on the granddaddy of all providential verses, Romans 8:28? We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. Know this, whatever you happen to be going through now, there's a point coming where understanding will come. You go, oh, now I see. You'll have an aha moment, and it'll all make sense. You'll say, God was all over this. He was there all along. I didn't see it, but He was there. And if you haven't done so by that point, you'll just let all bitterness go, all the questions of why go. You'll let those things go, because, and you'll praise God because He made it all work together for your good and for others' good. I mean, that's what God did for Joseph and his brothers. That's what God did for Jerry Sitzer. That's what God has done in your life before, and He will continue to do for you and for me. That's the providence of God. Let's pray. Lord, thank You for who You are. Lord, thank You that Your hand is involved in our lives in so many different ways. Lord, would You give us grace, the ability to trust You even when we don't see that. You did that with Joseph and his brothers. And you've done that throughout history. And You've done that in our lives before. Lord, help us to rest in who You are, because You hold it all together. Thank You for an understanding of Your providence. And we pray this in Your name. Amen.